Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder, it's a new week, maybe even a new president, as it looks like Joe Biden, we believe, or I think we can absolutely say, has won his nomination for the presidency of the United States with Kamala Harris. Things were crazy over the weekend, and we have started a new concept on The Attitude. And as I've told folks, Calvin Trillin is to the nation as ST is to the attitude. It is a bit of political verse. His temper is often volcanic. Now Trump's in a state of panic with his ship sinking. What is his party thinking? Even rats scurried off the Titanic. Now for our Rethink the Week, we are Zooming this, as you know, on Sunday afternoon. You will be hearing this on Monday for the first time. We have a great group of talkers. Joining us is Paul Peter Jessup. He is a former Republican from the great state of New Hampshire. He is currently an attorney in New York, incredibly thoughtful. And I said to Paul Peter, so how are you, Paul Peter? And what was your answer?
I am.
I know. That's how I feel. Joining us from the great state of North Carolina, from North Carolina State, is a professor of political science, Stephen Green. And welcome back, Stephen. And I asked the question, so isn't North Carolina decided? And you said, well, yes, it is, but no, it's not. So welcome back. And why is that like a mixed answer?
Because you might remember there was a case that went to the Supreme Court that gave us 9 days to allow for ballots to come in. And there were a lot of potential outstanding mail ballots. And so people have just, in this environment, wanted to be really conservative on seeing how those come in. But there will not be enough coming in to change the presidential or Senate races.
And how big was Trump's margin in North Carolina?
Oh, gosh, if I was a better political science professor, I would know this. Over 100,000 votes, I'm okay. Pretty sure. Just not mathematically possible with the votes coming in.
Okay. And back is Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a professor at Southern New Hampshire University, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar. And I want to welcome Dean back. And at some point, Dean, we're going to have to like put me into therapy, because as I was watching the returns in New Hampshire, I noticed that at the top of the ticket, Biden wins, Shaheen wins, our two members of Congress win. And then it was like straight Republican, right down from the governor, executive counselor, Senate, and House. And in New Hampshire, Republicans had a heyday. They may not have done well at the top, but they cleaned House at the bottom, Dean. So you'll have to explain to me what the H happened in the state that I call home. Welcome.
Hi, Arnie. Good to be with you.
It was amazing. And our last guest is Dave Leventhal. Dave Leventhal is living in Washington, D.C. He is now working for Business Insider. And I have to tell you, Dave, all of us were kind of jealous of you, because you got to see the reaction on Black Lives Matter. What is it? What is it called? In front of the White House. Black Lives Plaza. I mean, all I know is that it's in front of the White House, and it just irritates the hell out of Donald Trump. But welcome to the program. And really quickly, before we get into sort of the rest of the conversation, what's it like in D.C. right now? Are people like just euphoric?
Well, it was jubilant. And mind you, Arnie, D.C. traditionally will go about 90% vote-wise for the Democrat. It was around 95% the last vote counts I had, and Donald Trump just edged out some of the other candidates on the ballot, Joe Jorgensen, the libertarian candidate, among others. So I think that's an indication of where the city is at politically, of course. But my son and I, we did a much overdue hike yesterday, and on our drive through DC to get out into the country, people are standing on bridges and they're lining the streets. I mean, it was quite a scene, not just in front of the White House, but all over the city, and sort of just a mass release that we saw all across the country and in places that especially very strong blue cities, where people just finally, you know, let loose a lot of emotions that had been pent up and building for many, many months, one could argue years.
So let me start with you, Stephen. I was listening to Joe Biden's speech on Saturday, and I was never a big Biden supporter. I sort of say that he sort of becomes the moment. I tweeted out, Joe Biden is a nice guy. He's just a nice man. And I didn't realize how much I craved that kind of voice and that kind of conversation. I described it this way. It's like eating a piece of warm Anadama bread on a cold night. It has all that. It was kind of folksy and charming and I needed the release. And it wasn't until he started speaking that it really hit me that was important for me. And I don't know whether the rest of the country felt that way, but as the tears were rolling down my cheeks, not because I was elated about his win, but I was elated about the fact that I didn't have to feel brittle anymore.
Yeah, no, exactly. I had very similar thoughts last night. And again, just such a sense of relief, right? That this great weight has been lifted from our shoulders. And honestly, I have not been a huge fan of Joe Biden myself, but he met the moment, you know? And I was like, wow, this is actually just good. Forget any kind of low bar for Biden. What he was doing, how he was presenting, how he was saying. And again, just more than anything else, after 4 years of Donald Trump, to just see, this is what a president talks like. Even if it's somebody I didn't really like George W. Bush, say, or going way back, the other George Bush, this is what a president talks like, and they at least try to unify us, at least rhetorically. And it was just so nice to have that. And I was, you know, I'm going to talk to my students this week who have, you know, many who have only ever really heard Donald Trump speak. It's like, this is what a president sounds like, and this is good, and as it should be.
Exactly. So, Paul Peter, one of the things I also sort of thought about as I saw all the family members and all the kids and all the grandkids and the babies in his arms, I'm like, there's joy. There's joy. We haven't seen joy in the White House since Donald Trump got elected. I mean, there's no sense of family. There's no sense of relationship. We know there's no empathy. I mean, he hasn't even had to spell the word empathy. But what we saw was kind of a little bit, I hate to say this, it kind of felt a little bit like a combination of the Donna Reed Show and Leave It to Beaver and you know, Make Room for Daddy. It was just all those things. You could tell how old I am. But it was an emotion and a family that I think also, I understand that 70 million people voted for Donald Trump. But even in that 70 million, of which, I don't know, 55% of them are supposedly white women voted for Donald Trump, they had to feel a little bit interested in what they saw happening and how he talked, because it had to ring familiar for them too, even if they voted for Donald Trump, Paul Peter.
If you think about how Biden started his campaign, going back to when folks didn't think he was going to get the nomination and he was doing poorly, did poorly in Iowa, as everyone knows, he was very consistent. He talked about civility. He talked about decency. He talked about the presidency being something that people need to look up to. He talked about basically being a role model. And so when we see joy, as you described it, and will it resonate with other people? I think it will, because he's setting a standard. He's reminding us of our better angels. And that's what he did. Yeah. You know, he is, and we all agree, he's a decent man, and he's the right man for the moment, if you think about it. And if you think about who the other candidates who ran for president, would they have been the right candidate for the moment? If you think, the word that immediately always comes to mind when I think Biden is decent.
Well, I think there were a lot of decent candidates, but let me say something to you, Dean Spiliotis. But here's the difference, is that there's going to be a lot of knuckle dragging within the Trump administration about helping transition from the Trump administration to the new administration. In fact, they may put every barrier and bar. The wonderful thing about having Joe Biden is that he's been there for 8 years. He knows where the bathrooms are. He knows who the important people are. He knows which bureaucrats to call. He knows so much. So there won't be the same learning curve for him that there would have been for absolutely everybody else, Dean Spiliotis. And to a large extent, I feel like for the next 70 days or however many days that are left between now and his getting sworn in, he might actually sort of almost create sort of a mini government in exile while they're waiting to actually start off. Because even if Donald Trump is not going to be helpful or useful, he is literally going to be doing all the things that you would normally see during a transition, maybe without the transition, because guess what? Donald Trump has hollowed out government anyway. So a lot of people that he would be calling aren't even on the government payroll. So they've got time to talk to him. Am I right, Dean?
Yeah, you know, you should not underestimate the cost benefit of having someone come in with that kind of experience. You know, history, recent presidential history is littered with administrations who came in from out of town, did not have a lot of prior experience with the ways of Washington. You know, that can be a benefit, obviously, when you're running for president. But then when you actually have to get down to governing, it can be a real challenge. So certainly having Biden's experience and a number of those around him as well can make a difference. There are aspects of the presidential transition that need to be triggered by the current administration. I think the GSA, the Government Service General Services Administration, needs to provide additional funding. That can, in theory, be held up a little bit. But you're right. I think that they've actually been at work. I mean, all campaigns are to some extent, but it sounds like the Biden folks in particular have been very diligent about planning. They're going to have a series of executive orders ready to go to reverse a lot of the bureaucratic decision-making that President Trump has undertaken. So it sounds like they're going to hit the ground running. They already have, I think, some transition space up and running, but there are ways in which the current administration can make things more or less difficult for them. I mean, part of it is kind of symbolic and, tradition, but part of it actually deals with the ability to have access to what you need to have access to. And we'll get a preview on Monday when Biden is supposed to announce his pandemic group that's going to take on the pandemic. And so we'll see what kind of contours that announcement has.
So Dave, so you're down in DC anyway, and so this is really great, and you're covering this sort of whole sort of conversation that's happening about the transfer. So I'm going to be a jerk here, but that's no surprise. I kept thinking, what does Donald Trump value? He values money and power. Well, he just basically is getting the message he's kind of losing some of that power, all right? And whether the Republicans, we said, the rats have scurried off the Titanic in our opening limerick, but he's not going to have power. But he does want money, but he can do really destructive things between now and the inauguration. And I was thinking, maybe I should call Jeff Bezos and call Bloomberg and call Steyer and say, why don't you put together like a GoFundMe? Only billionaires have to put the money into the GoFundMe. And you say, here, Donald, don't do a thing till you leave and we'll give you $1 billion. I mean, there was no policy you were running on. You hollowed out government. This was really about you. You always thought that you wanted to sort of form some kind of a media company. Don't do a thing, because I am really afraid of the people he'll fire, but of course they can always be rehired. But there are other things he can do that are so damaging. And I'm wondering that, as you've been talking to folks in Washington, other than the firing scenarios, what else could he do? Could he pass executive orders? I'm just, it's such a short window. I'm just wondering whether he could do anything that's even close to permanent, or is it anything that we just basically know immediately will be retracted as soon as Biden gets into office?
I don't think Donald Trump at this point knows what Donald Trump is going to truly do over the next 10 weeks. And anyone who tells you here in DC or otherwise that they know how Donald Trump is going to act during these next 10 weeks, just make sure not to buy a bridge from them, okay? Because we have a really fluid situation. I think that would be a colossal understatement. And Arnie, we're in the middle of a pandemic still. In many places around the country, it's as bad as it's ever been. The economy, although it's improved by some measures, is still absolutely positively rotten in others. People, tens of millions who are hurting right now, who want economic relief of some sort, are quite literally getting kicked out of their houses in their homes and can't put food on the table. So, you know, the notion of Donald Trump doing nothing, or for that matter, Congress and Donald Trump doing nothing, would be absolutely disastrous for a number of people. So in a way, we can't afford as a country to just kind of punt for the next 2.5 months. The question then is, well, what's Donald Trump going to do about it? Now, you can get into some pretty exotic, wild scenarios. We wrote a story a couple days ago about all the legal peril that Donald Trump faces starting in January, on January 20th, when he no longer has presidential privilege. I mean, he is facing criminal and he's facing civil and federal level and state level matters that affect his presidency, his business, his political campaign. So, you know, might Donald Trump decide to pardon himself? Might he decide to resign the presidency and hand it over to Mike Pence? Well, I don't think so, but who really knows what Donald Trump's going to do? Is he just going to head to Mar-a-Lago for the rest of his presidency and just kind of hang out there? Right. It's very unclear at this point. But I think the one thing that could be very problematic is the notion that Donald Trump is just going to kind of quit and go AWOL, and you know, off we are for the next 10 weeks with kind of Congress holding down the fort.
So you know, so Stephen, as I'm listening to Dave, a lot of Republican governors drank the Kool-Aid. They followed Donald Trump, whether it was, you know, governors in the Midwest, in Oklahoma, whether it's Florida, they basically did, even Kemp in Georgia, to some extent, Governor Abbott in Texas, where we're seeing, you know, the numbers just are spiking. And yet we know that this winter is going to be horrific. As the bodies increase in number, as the number of people are increased that we're going to require hospitalization, how quickly are those Republican governors who were so willing to embrace Donald Trump, are they not going to bang the door down on Mitch McConnell and say, we want the relief yesterday? Because at some point in time, they can't be suicidal. I mean, you can't walk over so many bodies. You can't crush your healthcare system in your state and think, one, that you won't get blamed for it, number one, but number two, realizing that there's a pot of money that could come out of Washington, what is holding them back? Because Trump is, you know, a non-starter, he's gonna be gone. And the only thing else that's gonna be gone are gonna be anything in the way of a political legacy for them if their economy tanks and there is just death and destruction from what's happening from this pandemic. Because 2 months now, it's just a lot of people who are sick.
You make a really compelling case. But, you know, I'm usually the optimist, right? But here, you know, I'm just, people are so all in on Donald Trump. And, you know, we talk in political science all the time, we say party idea is a hell of a drug, right? That it just makes you delusional in how you're seeing the world. And Trumpism is an even stronger drug. And, you know, again, I hope you're right. And I think there is reason to believe that you are. But I'm also really concerned that people are still so in on their Trumpism, and that with Trumpism kind of comes denying the empirical reality of this virus, even as your hospital wards are getting overwhelmed, that I'm concerned about the ability for these Republican governors who have gone all in on Trumpism to do what's needed to be done and to put the pressure on representatives in Congress to do what's needed to be done.
So Paul Peter, I'm getting calls from people in Texas because this show airs in Texas. And of course we're seeing the numbers just going through the roof. And so you have the people who have drunk the Kool-Aid and the governors who have drunk the Kool-Aid and the Republicans who are basically following Trump. But there are people like me who don't want to die. There are people like me that have families, because now this isn't just about whether, you know, you can do open carry. Now you're doing open COVID, all right? And open COVID is a hell of a lot more dangerous than open carry. Because at least with open carry, I can see you and I can walk away, or I can figure out a way to somehow manage to survive. With COVID, it is invisible. It is everywhere. It is rising. It is killing my doctors. It's making it more difficult for my children to go to school. We now know that while children may survive COVID, they may have some kind of pre-existing condition for the rest of their lives. That's not my goal for my child. I am actually upset about it, because if they continue to follow the denialism of Trump, it's not just them that they are hurting, but they've lost their president. They've lost their sort of master of the universe. And now they're beginning to really harm me. And I don't know how that is going to create a level of stability or an ability to govern.
It may not. One of the things that I found fascinating, you look at Iowa, which Trump won comfortably. During his presidency, farm bankruptcies increased by 140%.
Oh, jeez.
And they still voted for Trump. Yeah. If you go back to Texas, and this is the Sunday before election, you're looking at, what were the numbers I came up with? You're looking at almost 900,000 cases of COVID in Texas before the election, and you're looking at almost 18,000 Texans who died.
Yeah.
So is this a matter of being in denial? I think, you know, we talk about pollsters being wrong and having to reevaluate how we poll. I think we have to reevaluate how we analyze this from this standpoint. What attracts people to an authoritarian figure like Donald Trump, who's a pathological liar, tells them what they want to hear, and for some reason, these are not stupid people who voted for him, but they can rationalize voting for him. That's the question that we have to figure out, because one of the things that Biden has to do, he says he wants to be the president of all people. Well, that's wonderful. He also has to think about this. Maybe he doesn't say it. Rehabilitation. Why did these people vote for Donald Trump?
Right.
How do you rationalize it? Now, I've said this again and again. This is not a liberal issue. It's not a conservative issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. This is about basic human decency and common sense. And if you go down a list of things, he paid $750 in taxes, and people don't seem to care. How do you not care? That's money that was not going to support our troops. Some of our people in the armed forces are on food stamps, and you're not upset that he only paid $750. You can go down a list of things.
Right. So
Biden's job is gonna have to be, how do I reach these people and try to understand why they voted the way they did?
We must be drinking the same coffee, because just this morning, Dean Spiliotis, I remembered in 2016, Donald Trump, according to Gallup, had the highest negatives of any candidate running for president of the United States. Of course, Hillary was number two, but he was number one, okay? That was 2016. 4 years later, I know he lost, but he got the second highest number of votes ever in US history, with probably the highest voter turnout in US history. We're talking about 70 million. And I'm just listening to Paul Peter talk about rehabilitation. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. And after 4 years of lying and misogyny and racism and growing inequality and lying about the pandemic and walking over dead bodies and, you know, basically losing our position within the free world, all those things that Paul Peter was talking about, he still got 70 million. That's a lot of rehabilitation. And I'm just trying to figure out what happened to America. That many people would be willing to basically disconnect from what they see, what they taste, and what they hear, and believe him.
If I can,
Call Peter real quickly. Go on. Go.
I would say this is not so much what happened to America. It's about human nature, and it means Americans are no different than anyone else in the world. It's human nature. That's what we have to focus in on.
All right, Dean.
Yeah, no, I was simply going to say that this was a very high turnout election. The belief is that that President Trump, with the rallies in the last final weeks of the campaign, was able to basically use fear to mobilize what political scientists typically call, you know, low propensity voters or low information voters, people who don't have a high propensity to participate, for whom his particular worldview, his ideas were, you know, a lot of the behavior you discussed were either not deal breakers, which says one thing about people, or simply they were willing to kind of hold their nose. You know, we've talked a lot about evangelicals who, it's a transactional relationship. They want the outcomes, even if they don't like him. And so they found enough of those folks to turn out, which is why you've got this almost 150 million people voting. But I have to say, it was very interesting to me the last few nights before the election, as the polling data started to suggest a very comfortable win for Biden. And I think it has turned out to be a reasonably comfortable win. Part of the problem is the way that the votes have been reported that has created this narrative that we could have had a different narrative on election night with a different process of reporting. But Be that as it may, I think a lot of Democrats, you heard the last couple nights before the election, starting to think that this was going to be a complete and utter repudiation, that we would basically be saying to the world, it was a fluke 4 years ago. We didn't know we were going to get this guy. We're now repudiating him and everything he stands for. And that hasn't quite happened or played out that way. I still think we've sent a clear message to the, 75 million. I mean, Biden's going to win by something like 7 million votes. And I think he's going to be over 50%, something 51 or 52% of the vote. So those are all good things. As the mayor of Paris said, welcome back, America. So I think we do have some, there's something to show for that. But it is true that there were, I think a lot of Democrats were shocked that there are 70 some odd million people in our country who are comfortable with all we just saw. And, I was talking to acquaintances who were saying things like, well, maybe first they would say, well, we have 70 million people voted for him. Maybe I'm sort of, over exaggerating just how bad Trump was for the culture. And then they pause and say, no, he was really bad. And people still voted for him.
So, Dave, we interviewed a guy from Texas. We interviewed a guy from Iowa. I mean, these are really important political, knowledgeable people. Our Texas guy ran Andrew Rich's campaign. Art Cullen is the Pulitzer Prize winning editor of the Something Lake Times. And we were talking about all these states that were going to flip. Okay. And they were guaranteed that it was going to flip and it was going to be almost a romp. So I'm trying to figure out, what were they seeing on the ground that turned out not to materialize? What the hell happened to the polling? And is polling of any value anymore, Dave Leventhal? And then here's a question that came in from one of our engineers at the radio station. He said, so if it turns out that polling sucked and we can't trust the polling, then tell me how we can trust the post-election analysis. So they're telling me, what the gender difference was, and they're telling me what the religious difference was, and how one race voted this way or the other. So why is the exit polling any better than the, entry polling? I mean, it's like, does polling have any value in a world of social media where nobody picks up their phone and nobody tells you the truth anyway? I mean, I'm just wondering, what do you do other than polling? Because it seems to me that once again, it was majestic disappointment.
You've heard this 1,000 times, and I'm sure your listeners have too. Polling is by its nature, a snapshot in time. It does not predict what happens on election day. It also, too, doesn't predict how many people are actually going to show up. You can, on a phone or when you respond to a poll, you can say, yeah, I'm probably going to vote. And when I do vote, I'm probably going to vote for Donald Trump or for Joe Biden. But do you show up? Do you send in your mail ballot? Do you actually participate? So there's that. And there's also a notion that some people just don't tell the truth when they answer the poll, that they might in their heart support Donald Trump, but maybe they say they're undecided, or maybe they say they're going to vote for the other guy because they're embarrassed. And that that is a thing. OK, how great a thing. I will leave that to the political scientists in the conversation. But polling is not perfect. And it's probably less perfect today than it was 20 years ago for various reasons. So when you put that all together, can we rely on polls? Well, polls are still informative. Polls will still, give you good information about the trajectory of the race, but nobody ever should take to the bank what a poll says, even one very close to election day, that is going to be the ultimate predictor of the outcome of an election, either in an individual state or across the country.
All right, everyone. We're going to take a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. We've been talking with Dave Leventhal from Business Insider, Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Green from North Carolina State, and Paul Peter Jessup, former Republican and currently an attorney in New York. We'll be right back.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh. When the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
glory, glory.
Hands to the heavens. No man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, glory. Oh,
glory, glory.
Now the war is not over. Victory isn't won. But we'll fight on to the finish. And then when it's all done, we'll cry glory. Oh, glory. Oh, oh.
Selma is now. For every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. No one can win a war individually. It take the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory, the coming of the Lord. My eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, glory.
Glory.
Oh,
welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. It's a panel of what happened last week, which seems like a year, but to some, the celebration, and to some, they're trying to figure out how they can litigate. Anyway, our fabulous panel of guests includes Stephen Green, a professor of North Carolina State, professor of political science, Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University, Dave Leventhal, now with Business Insider, with their Washington, D.C., sort of, I guess you're their Washington, D.C. editor. Is that how you are described, Dave Leventhal, at Business Insider?
Senior Washington correspondent is my fancy title now.
Oh, very good. And Paul Peter Jessup, who is a former Republican and currently an attorney in New York. So Dave Leventhal, just before we went to the break, made some comment about polling that people would like either not answer because they don't want to, or they would be reluctant to answer because maybe they were embarrassed. So I got to ask you a question, Stephen. I know I've never been embarrassed about saying I'm voting for Joe Biden. But if people are embarrassed about saying that they're voting for Donald Trump, shouldn't that trigger some kind of response inside of them that they're voting for someone that is so despicable that maybe it's not who they're voting for that's a problem, but that the fact that they are voting for him is a problem? I mean, right there, this sort of quiet, under the rock Donald Trump voter, the person that doesn't want anyone to know. If you don't want someone to know in a democracy who you are voting for to be the leader of your country, there is something radically wrong here, Stephen. And I'm just trying to figure out, I'm listening to, you know, Paul Peter talk about rehabilitation. I'm thinking about what country do you belong to?
Well, for starters, there's actually not any evidence that we have shy Trump voters. There's not evidence that people support Donald Trump and then are afraid to tell it to pollsters. There's been a couple of people out there pushing this theory, largely without evidence. What we do have evidence for is that polls are clearly missing some Trump voters. And that can happen for a lot of reasons, and I've been more than obsessed with this, right? But for whatever reasons, the people who support Donald Trump are probably simply less likely to actually pick up that phone or respond to that text message to then supply the answer as to who are they voting for. And then, you know, maybe there's some shy Trump voters, but in one sense, we live in communities. And if you live in a community that is full of Biden voters, but my guess is there would be as many Biden voters who live in Trump communities who might be shy Biden voters. But, you know, overall, you know, one of my fascinations with this election as a political scientist has been how the polling was wrong, how the polling was systematically wrong in certain states twice in a row to the same degree, Wisconsin, Ohio, et cetera. And yet in other states was dead on, like look at Georgia. And so, you know, as a scholar, I'm really excited kind of to see what we can learn from this going forward. Because polling's not hopelessly broken. Georgia shows us, for example, Arizona was close, you know. But I think we will learn about polling. And also, I'm optimistic some things about the American public by better understanding where these big polling errors are coming from. Because I can't help it. I'm always an optimist, Arnie.
Oh, okay, before I let you go, though, I also wanted to comment on something else about this election. And that is, I feel like, once again, who's saved our democracy are African Americans, or people of color. And it is, it's as, you know, as they have to form Black Lives Matter, as they see inequality, as they've seen us write public policy that ultimately harms them and doesn't allow them to acquire assets. That's why I love, you know, The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. And yet, when you look at this election, once again, who saves democracy is the African-American community. And in particular, what I think is the most interesting of this whole election is there is one city in America, Stephen Green, that I can point to that really saved us. It is the poorest city in the United States. It is Philadelphia. It happens to be the poorest city in the United States. What does that also say about sort of the idea that, you know, democracy is about, you know, everyone has equal opportunity and this is the place of, you know, equality and justice. And yet the people who suffered the most from this democracy are the ones that have saved it over and over again. Steve, it's just shocking.
Yeah, it's you have done Nicole Hannah-Jones's work for the 1619 Project, you know, which has made this argument very compellingly. And again, we know this, and it's been super important. And I, you know, actually, it also makes me think of your earlier question is, how can we say anything without polling? And actually, we still can, because we can look at actual election returns and see that in Philadelphia, right? We see which election returns are from Philadelphia and say, look, thank you. They saved us. And from, you know, the group of individuals which might have the least reason to believe in democracy, right, to still have the faith in the democratic process and turn out and honestly save what could very well have slid away from democracy if Donald Trump was reelected.
So, Paul Peter, I was talking to a group of Norwegian officials and folks from Norway on Friday. And the thing that really kind of shocks them is how we conduct our elections. It's a crapshoot. It's a function of geography. It's a function of a county. It's a function of a state. Is it a Republican legislature? Is it a Democratic legislature? And to some extent, I mean, I said this the other day, when you are living in a community where you have to wait online for 8 hours and there is no election day holiday and you have to find a babysitter, or you may lose, you know, hours of work, you might even lose your job. How is that not a poll tax? I wait 15 seconds to vote in Concord, New Hampshire. I can do it easily. And in a place where anyone could do absentee balloting, it was very easy. Or in a place where it's all mail-in voting. But in a lot of places, that's just not the case. You know, it's a real impediment. How is it possible to say one man or one person, one vote in this country, when that is a complete and total lie? And why hasn't that been challenged? Because it depends on geography. It doesn't depend on anything else.
I waited 2.5 hours to vote. And I'm not in New York City, I'm in upstate New York. I think there are many things that this experience will teach us. And I think there'll be a lot of benefits that come from this experience. And one of the issues you raise should be one of them. And the fact, have we really ever grappled with this notion before? We've talked about it, but now it's front and center. And I think there are many things that Joe Biden has to do. And one of them will have to be addressing this issue. And I think there are ways to address it.
Well, but Dean, we've always left, you know, elections are the province of the states. Well, that's great. So, you know, lucky you, depending on where you live. I mean, that was the whole point of, I mean, one of the reasons why you go to the federal government is that you want some kind of universality. You wanted at least a minimum wage of $7.25 everywhere, as opposed to, you know, some places having a minimum wage, some not having a minimum wage. And yet this is the most important part of creating government, of creating this thing that we call a democracy, that it should be such a 3,000 county standard. It isn't even a 50 state standard. To me, seems to completely undermine anything that we want to value as some sort of fair democratic institutions. Is there anything that the federal government could actually do to change that?
That's a tough question. You know, I think there would be kind of mixed views on whether or not that's something that people would be willing to do. Obviously, it may vary to some extent by party. But, you know, the federal government can certainly provide additional resources. They have in the past. The HAVA Act was something that's provided additional federal resources. You know, enforcing some kind of uniform standard across the states would probably trigger a bit of a states' rights debate. But nonetheless, I think there certainly are, you know, particularly if states themselves have the money to do the kind of upgrades they want to do, to put in the kind of system where you can either, you know, either make it easier to vote by mail or have absentee ballots or provide for technology at polling stations. You know, in this current iteration, the issue was PPE for poll workers. But, you know, this is all subsumed in a larger partisan debate. You know, we've seen Democrats complain that it's voter suppression, and Republicans say, no, it's an attempt to ensure that everything is done properly and legally. But it is, you know, even factoring in the record-breaking turnout, just seeing the lines of people, I guess I've been lucky. Every place I've ever lived, I've never really encountered a line. And when
white privilege.
Yeah, well, and I've lived in Chicago. I've lived in all kinds of different places, and it looks like when I look at that stuff, it looks like a different country to see the lines of people waiting for 6-8 hours in the heat back during, you know, back in the summer for spring for primaries, and now with this current. You know, that has to be such a badge of honor that you're willing to wait for 6 or 8 hours instead of doing something else with your time is really unfortunate. But any attempt to systematize or enforce some kind of uniform standards, I think this is going to be challenged in the courts.
Can I just add something, Arnie? Dean just used the word a badge of honor. And Arnie, you had said before about all the Black folks voting, even though they were from the poorest districts, and it's amazing they still have the faith in democracy. But I think if you look at the history of Black people voting in this country, you know, you go back before 1965, and people were just basically not allowed to vote, and they were harmed or killed if they dared to try to register to vote, and fighting for that. And the alternative to not voting, it's not like you have to believe that much in democracy in order to see that it's really your only shot. So those visuals that I have in my mind of Black folks in Georgia waiting out there for 8 hours, even to vote early, you know, they had several weeks of early voting, and these folks are out there on the first day waiting in line. I started wondering to myself, you know, why are they waiting a long time? Come back on day two or day three or day four. But by God, they know what happened in the history of even in their lifetimes in this country, and them being shut out and lynching being winked at and all the other horrors that went on. And they see voting as it's not so much a badge of honor, Dean. It is kind of a life and death matter. And so, you know, people are still in the streets trying to protect Black lives. I think they're waiting in those lines because they want to make bloody sure that their votes are counted and get this guy out of the White House.
And I think Stacey Abrams, we can't talk enough about her, Dave Leventhal, that she really did remind them that they have power. That's her message. It wasn't just about get out the vote. It was about the fact that vote is power. This is your power. White people aren't the only ones with power. Donald Trump isn't the only ones with power. Billionaires aren't the only ones with power. You actually have power, and it's on a piece of paper, which is just kind of remarkable, but I think it was really successful. But I want to go to Georgia, Dave. So no matter what happens, we have two runoffs in Georgia. Okay, we have John Ossoff against Perdue and Raphael Warnock against Kelly Loeffler. Now, here's my question about Georgia, because we already know that Georgia has been pumped, okay? And we've got Stacey done an incredible job. We saw amazing turnouts. What is the Georgia political landscape going to be like for those Republicans running when there ain't a Donald Trump in the White House?
Well,
what Republican Party is going to show up? What about Donald Trump? Is he going to come marching in? But who is he? Like, he's not president. So I'm just kind of wondering, how is this Georgia thing going to play out, given the fact that it isn't President Trump anymore?
Well, first of all, I if you're a Georgia resident, I hope you like political ads, because you're going to see more over the next few months than you ever have seen in your life, which is saying a lot given all that you've seen over the past many months. So that's it's going to be absolutely incredible. I suspect that it'll break dollars and cents wise records for runoff elections. But to your question, Arnie, I mean, that's the huge X factor in all of this. All the Senate races that were won by Republicans, and they had some great successes, of course, in possibly holding on to the Senate and winning in Iowa, winning in North Carolina, races that you know, Democrats thought that they had, and they did not. They're going into this on a high note of a sort. And Mitch McConnell, he's got a whole apparatus that is set for the Senate, Senate Leadership Fund, and various other entities. They've got a ton of money. So, but the question is, all right, is it going to be enough to say, Republicans, we must band together, we must hold the Senate, or else the Democrats are going to run the table. They will have everything. That's going to be the message I would expect that they're going to hear, and less about Donald Trump. I mean, ultimately, you're kind of tethering these candidates to a guy who lost, and that's very risky, as much as a lot of people are still going to absolutely love. And
people really will go into a voting booth and talk about running the table. I mean, is that what they think about? I mean, oh my God, they're going to control everything. I'm just wondering, is the message only about who controls, or is the message about minimum wage, or is the message about the pandemic, or is the message about, access to healthcare? I mean, is there anything else? Running the table, what does that get you? I'm just trying to figure out, can you even message about policy at all, or has that basically been put to the back of the bus? Yeah. And the only thing, that's the part that's
Hey, Arnie, can I jump in?
Yeah, real quickly.
Yeah, Arnie, this is going to be the most nationalized statewide race in American history.
I agree.
It's going to be completely about the control of Senate. It's going to have virtually nothing to do with policy. It's going to be Republicans arguing that if the Democrats win the two seats, Kamala Harris will break a tie. You're going to get liberal judges. You're going to get Medicare for all. You're going to get a Green New Deal. All things that progressives may want and Democrats may want, but Republicans are going to use fear to motivate turnout.
Okay.
It's going to be probably the most expensive runoff in American history, is my guess.
And they're going to run the table in socialism,
So here's what I'm thinking. You've got what Stacey Abrams was able to do incredibly in Georgia. You now have the first Black vice president ever. So now we have really an interesting, we have power in the White House, and we have Stacey from Georgia. Is that combination going to be successful in a state where the African-American community is really beginning to feel they have some political muscle? They realize now that not only is the power available to them, but everybody realizes they've got even more power than president, because if they can deliver the Senate, they are beyond the kingmakers. They're changing the whole course of history. So I'm kind of curious, has anyone done the nose count in Georgia? But would there be enough voters? I mean, literally everyone is going to be ID'd. Everyone. I mean, if you turn 18 the hour before the election, they will find you. I'm just wondering whether that has the potential to really make Georgia possibly produce two Democratic senators?
I mean, I think maybe, but it's a heavy lift. My favorite idea is that, hey, instead of spending all this money on ads, Democrats should pay like 100,000 people to move to Georgia before December 7th, which is probably a better investment of the money. But, you know, one of the things I really do fear is that, you know, back 20 years ago, political science was obsessed with the ideas of split ticket voting and divided government, because that was the era back then. And there really was, you know, a non-trivial subset of people who really did like the idea of divided government. And shall we say there really are reflexive centrists. And it's like, well, you know, we probably do need that check on Joe Biden. So I am concerned that maybe some more of these, you know, college educated suburban voters who do seem to be trending Democratic, that maybe they're like, you know, yeah, I liked Biden, we have to get rid of Trump, but I'm afraid we're going to have the AOC socialist agenda. So that's what I worry about, but we'll see.
Can you imagine? I want to check on Grandpa Joe. I go back to how I felt on Saturday, where I felt like, oh my God, he's a nice guy. And I'm thinking, so the marketing tool in Georgia is, you want to check on that grandpa. I mean, ugh. And on that note, it's the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. Thank you, gentlemen. We have Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Green from North Carolina State, Dave Leventhal from Business Insider based in Washington, D.C., and of course, Paul Peter Jessup, my former Republican. I feel so badly for you, and currently an attorney in New York. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Thank you.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on. Yeah. Oh.